Well, you had 230 yeses and 198 noes, and that's a win.
It's a win, and I can't thank you all enough. It's great leadership. I'm glad glad we moved it the way we did. It's a strong message to the American people that the members of the U.S. Congress have heard loud and clear that if we set priorities and watch our spending habits, that we can send some meaningful money back to the people.
President Bush on the telephone with House Speaker Dennis Hastert on Thursday. The House of Representatives handed the president a major legislative victory on Thursday by approving the cornerstone of Mr. Bush's tax cut plan and across-the-board reduction of nearly $1 trillion. Dan Shore joins us. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott.
And this was really a put on the fast track. Why?
Well, I'll tell you, the president or maybe his advisors felt a need to establish early momentum. They wanted to go bang, 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 get something to show that they had the clout to do this. So you have this rather unusual spectacle, a major tax bill reported out by the Ways and Means Committee with no hearings, adopted by the House on an accelerated schedule in a mainly partisan vote. 10 Democrats voted for it. But, you know, this is not quite the hand-in-hand bipartisanship that President Bush promised in that speech to Congress. Now, as he travels around, he scoffs at the Democratic outbursts of frustration, as he calls them. This may have a price in the alienation of the Southern Democrats who were so essential in 1981 to President Reagan's victory on taxes. Now there are going to be some problems there. Newspaper interviews along the way of his barnstorming trip, it is interesting that President Bush is already signaling some small willingness to compromise if it doesn't affect the basic structure of his bill, like, for example, the richest people, instead of coming down to 33%, may be put at 35%. Not important, but indicating let's deal.
How do you assess the impact he's had on people in the Senate? Because he needs to pick up a few Democratic votes there.
Well, he's done this thing now of going into three states where he did very well, but which have Democratic senators, North and South Dakota and Louisiana. And in these states, he's had a very good turnout of people who have come to see him. It remains to be seen whether he can generate enough steam among those voters to sway the senators from those states, or whether maybe there'll be some backlash among senators who don't appreciate being undercut.
Let us ask this week about the health of Vice President Cheney. He had a second heart procedure in 4 months this week. He's back at work. Any political effect?
Well, I'll tell you, a Cheney heart problem causes more uneasiness than you might expect in the case of a vice president, precisely because they've advertised his indispensability, right? Mm-hmm. But for Vice President Cheney, it must be a little uncomfortable knowing now that wherever he goes, he's being very closely watched, people asking, how do you feel, and then asking in a way they wouldn't ordinarily ask it. I think that they make it through this all right, but I think if there is one more episode of heart problems, then there is likely to be trouble. And what do I mean by trouble? Of course, then talk of resignation starts. You know, the interesting thing is that most of what Cheney does for Bush, he doesn't have to be vice president to do. He could do all of that, say, as a presidential counselor. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is Secretary of State Colin Powell, who said he wouldn't run for office, but never said he wouldn't accept office as a patriotic duty.
Oh, you mean vice president.
There you go.
Is it becoming a mixed blessing to be quite so indispensable for Mr. Cheney, a political burden?
Well, he said, I'm having a wonderful time, and I assume he is having a wonderful time, and all things being equal, you'd rather be indispensable than dispensable, but he pays a price for that.
This week, the Congress sent to the president legislation that would revoke ergonomics rules that were issued late in the Clinton administration.
Right.
How did that come about so quickly?
Well, here, this regulation, 10 years in the making, the supporter said would have prevented 4.6 million incidents of muscle, skeleton, carpal tunnel syndrome disorders. That would mean immense savings in health costs. Mm-hmm. But you can see saving the health costs, which are not there, but what for business saw was that it would cost industry $100 billion to install all the changes that were being demanded. And so what do you get? You get lobbyists, contributors working with great zeal. They got a party line vote. They handed labor a devastating defeat. Shows what can happen when White House and both chambers of Congress are on the same party's hands.
There was a consternation this week about a New York Times report that a tunnel was built by the United States under the Soviet and now Russian embassy.
Now that's the other tunnel syndrome. Okay.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word.
All right.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Yeah, I'll bet. Didn't the Soviets assume it was already bugged? I mean, why build such an expensive tunnel down there?
Well, I'll tell you, over the years, our intelligence community may be boastful about its technological capacity, has shown a great penchant for this kind of thing. I can remember that when they built a tunnel under the Berlin sector border, which, by the way, was also betrayed by a spy. Mm-hmm. And then we had submarines tapping underwater Soviet communications, also betrayed by a spy. I guess what seems silly today maybe looked different in the 70s at the height of the Cold War when this tunnel project was authorized. At least I would like to think so, because it is very, very hard to look at it now and say, why would they do such a ridiculous thing? I was particularly amused at the protest, by the way, that came from Moscow about this violation of diplomatic immunity. From Moscow, where the American embassy was once infested with microphones like fleas, so the Russians could hear everything going on there.
And getting back to Moscow, do we assume that there's a search on in Russia to find whoever it was that dropped the dime on Robert Hansen?
Yes, there is. And apparently we know about that how? By electronic surveillance. Apparently they're going through their missions in New York and in Washington and asking everybody about it. The Russians seem to assume that there's been a major leak from somebody probably among the Russian missions in the United States, maybe two. And so they are looking for a mole. And we are watching them look for the mole. It clearly had to be one simply because of the wealth of information, exchanges of letters with his case officers and all the rest of it that came out. I mean, that wasn't just somebody talking. Somebody turned over the whole file.
Yeah. More school violence in the United States this week. California, Pennsylvania, there were threats in Florida. We want to be careful about not drawing connections where none may exist. But Do you begin to get the idea there's a syndrome setting in American life?
Well, I don't know what you mean about not drawing connections. Our business is drawing connections, I think. I can remember being bullied myself in my childhood with fists. And what's changed now? Well, a diet of violence on television, video games, and now the internet. And violence becomes either an accepted norm for people or for some kids. It doesn't really happen. It's like seeing this thing on a screen. It doesn't happen. Some copycatting. And then, of course, the easy availability of guns. And notice that this time around, we used to have great outcries in Congress, and they try to get legislation which they normally didn't pass. And now they've about given up fighting the National Rifle Association in this Congress.
Let me ask about Israel. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has formed a broad-based cabinet. Violence and unrest continues. There's the prospect at the same time of a meeting that would have been almost unthinkable a few months ago.
Well, that's right. Yasser Arafat now says he's ready to start negotiations where they left off with Barak. Of course, Sharon says that he will not start negotiations until all violence has ceased. But you can have a meeting which you don't call negotiations. And clearly they are moving towards having some kind of face-to-face meeting between Sharon and Arafat to see whether there is any way, that they can get things started again.
Does Mr. Sharon need that meeting to keep a coalition together?
He needs something to keep the coalition together. It is what you call a very, very broad-based coalition going all the way from hawkishness to dovishness and all the rest. I don't think he's in a position to refuse it, but I don't think he has much hope for it.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.